Anymore, it seems more often.
Do you read or do you listen?
I read, so, and I like to read a physical book.
Are we live, Joe?
There's like 1,000 pages.
Okay. All right, good morning. We'll call the board meeting to order. First on the agenda is approval of the minutes from the August 1st meeting.
I move to approve as written.
I'll second.
Motion and second to approve the minutes as written. Any discussion? All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. No public comment has been requested today. Standing items, there's no executive committee actions, no decisions requiring affirmation, there's no variances. That brings us to investigation committee report.
Okay. Investigations met and issued 5 orders related to scope of practice issues. We also issued 2 orders for respondents with drug or alcohol issues. In those cases, the committee signed the suspension of respondent certification, stayed the suspension of responder certification, provided they remained active participants in a substance abuse treatment program. We also issued 32 orders for violations related to sponsoring organizations not providing training reports to staff within 30 days of the last day of class, and we adjourned.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments on that report? All right, that brings us to the office update. Director House.
So I'm going to pause just a second because I got a chat message again that the audio is not coming through. So I was actually the first item within here is that we had audio issues yesterday. We thought we have them fixed. So quick confirmation from Dr. Feynman and Dr. Selberg, are you able to hear what's going on?
Yes, I can hear okay.
Yeah, Judge, it's slightly here and there, but all in all, pretty good things.
All right. Well, we'll continue down that path then, and hopefully that's been resolved. So first item, obviously, we know there were audio issues yesterday. One thing, we are in the state's system on this, and it's outside of our control. So I can't change the settings on the microphones at all. So the microphones in front of you are to amplify volume within the room. The microphones in the ceiling are attempting to catch what's going on in the room. You have to talk loud enough for both of them to pick you up, is the big thing. The next side of it, the setting that we turned off yesterday, which did improve a little bit, is Teams has a noise suppression component within it where it tries to filter out background noise. So if there's conversations going on in multiple mics, it doesn't necessarily know because of the distance you are from the mic, whether it's background or not. So it just interprets it as background noise and will cancel it out. So yesterday, the cutting in and out of the audio was because we had conversations occurring within multiple mics and it thinking that it was just all background and it wasn't coming through near as well. So that was the issue seen yesterday. We'll see what we can do with it. But frankly, there's no requirement for the board to stream these or to try to put this out in that teleconference format. We may be better off just going back to the old phone sitting up here in the front and it picking up what's going on. But we're working through it. We're trying to get where we can on it. So hopefully today is much better. Hopefully it'll be, we'll try to figure something out in the interim between now and the December meeting as well. So that set aside, I'll kick off to the rest. Regulations that are in process, 10 of our 11 are sitting with the Attorney General's office waiting their approval. That's step 2 of that process for regulations. The other one is actually in step 3, But it's been in step three for a really long time. And step three is the Division of Budget approving the economic impact statement. So the regulation that's held up on that is the successful course completion and basically allows for testing to occur immediately upon successful course completion being received, no 7-day waiting period. So it's not like there's a cost associated to that at all. We're not sure why there's a hangup, but it was sent on July 1st, resent on August 18th, resent electronically again September 10th, after we had an in-person meeting with the Division of Budget about it. So we still haven't heard back on a stamp yet. The next step after that is for it to move on to the public comment period. So we would love to, we're pushing as hard as we can. We'll see what it comes up. It's not giving a warm, fuzzy feeling about the other 10 that are in the hopper and going to step into step three. We were hoping to have those in place by the end of the year, but at this point, I'd probably anticipate that that's probably going to be closer to the second quarter of 2026 before we see those really come into fruition. So maybe it'll speed up. We're hopeful on that side of it. Any questions about the regulations? All right. Updates for the agency. A couple short webinars are going to be coming up here shortly for our services who utilize the state's system, primarily for the services who are utilizing the state's EPCR system, so our Image Trend contract. They have a new functionality that they're rolling out called AI Assist. It currently is active within our system, but we shut it off for everybody because there are some major hiccups, I will say, within the side of the system. Not hiccups that cause concerns with the AI side of it, just the fact that we spent a lot of time ensuring that only certain fields showed up based upon the way things were answered so that we didn't get the whole pregnant male kind of thing, which I guess now there would be a couple. But so things like that wouldn't show up. We kind of said, hey, this shouldn't show up ever, so that we minimize that entry. That's called a visibility rule within our system. So AI Assist, when it works, which it does very well, will only feed information into fields that are visible at the time at which the button was activated. So our very first question on our state form is to put unit notified date in. And it basically then opens and unlocks the rest of the records. And then if it's a 911 transport, it then unlocks some more fields for them to fill out. So you have to get to the spot where you know the fields are going to be present in order for then it to work. So how it works, you dictate. It's the easiest way to think about it. You're speaking into the microphone of the device that you're using to enter the information into the patient care report. It parses what you're saying and says, okay, well, they told me the age of the patient. They told me the patient's name. They told me, you know, their date of birth. They told me what their chief complaint was. They gave a set of vital signs. Here's where all of that data should go into the report. And it pops up now as a checkbox for the provider to say, all right, is this really their first name? They say yes. It moves over to their first name. Was this their date of birth? You check and you go through that list. It records in 60 to 90 second bursts, and you can go through and knock that out. Also take some pictures. So you can take a picture of the driver's license and it will draw that information into the patient care report. So put the first name and the first name, last name, date of birth as it goes through their address. It will take pictures of prescription bottles and move that over into their medications along with dosage and frequency and whether it was current, not current. So some great functionality with the system. We tested it on a picture of a medication administration record, or a MAR, from a nursing home, which those in the field understand there's sometimes up to about 60 meds on there that they've got, it seems. But taking a picture of it, took all of that information, plopped it in to the current medications for the patient. So not a concern on the AI side of it processing it. It all remains internal within that run only. It is not stored on that device once it's parses it across, it deletes it back out. The user is 100% responsible for the information going in. It gives them the ability to edit. So if they said 160 for a pulse and it heard 16, they can go back in and change it to 160. If 140, they can edit all they want. There's that final verification before it actually populates the patient care report. So just things that we want to make sure are covered in depth with services before we make it active. So we will require services to attend one of the trainings, one of those webinars, before we make it active. Their attendance will make it active, but then the service can absolutely go back in and shut it off. If they say, you know what, this isn't for us, we don't want to try this right now, they can go back in, turn the functionality off. But we won't actually turn it on until they've attended. So questions about that? That was a pretty big piece.
A little bit. So how does it with services that are well, not even that, but agencies that are using even the state system, but importing vital signs and information out of a monitor into their report, mm-hmm. Does that
still works?
It doesn't interfere with each other.
Not at all.
Contradict what the monitor, what was imported versus what was dictated into the AI assist at all?
Nope.
Okay.
Just as if they were typing. That's why it's the AI assist. It's just as if they were typing it.
And it doesn't interfere with, so third party, like someone that like us that have our own image trend system, a lot of that information gets brought over through the CAD and already input into the report. When they do the CAD download, it doesn't override or change any of that.
Nope. And if it does, note that there's a conflict. So you said their first name was Joe, but their driver's license said Joseph. It'll ask you which you want to use.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. Good functionality. So obviously our vendor has that functionality. I would anticipate the other vendors do as well. I would love to say that it's unique, but there's nothing unique in the EPCR world except just the user interface side of it. So, I would anticipate the others will have that if they don't already have that and it's been running out. So, again, this is just specific to the state system. But since all of our ambulance services are able to use the state system, the webinar will be open to all. All right.
You have a time frame on that?
We will have the webinars done before the end of the year.
Perfect. All right. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Moving on, our amended fiscal year 26 budget and our fiscal year 27 budget have been completed and submitted, met the deadline as we always do, thanks to the very, very hard work of Suzette, because she takes the major portion of that and making sure that it gets into the systems, into the state's system, and then the narratives are ensured as the whip is cracked to make sure that I can get my portions of that typed out and in, and then sit down and just make that final determination. But she takes the lion's share of that load, and huge thanks to her for making sure that that happens each and every year. So that is submitted. We have not heard back any questions yet, but we also didn't hear back any questions last year. So usually because it's just very well done, and we explain things as to the point at which the Division of Budget and Legislative Research both understand. So, EIG, we talked about a little bit at the last meeting here. Your ask to us was to find out why it may not have been utilized. So we had some direct feedback. That the direct feedback was basically don't get rid of it. It wasn't why it wasn't being used other than it was just not needed at the time. But they very much encouraged that it continued in the pathway of being offered. So lots of indirect feedback on that side of it is our requests are up. So making it the comment here, asking the question did lead to a rise in watching EIG requests come up. So we got the same thing that we needed out of that in going forward. Still waiting to hear. There has been some comments about dollar amounts needing to be adjusted and such. We're still within about 15 to 20% of cost of it's being reported to us. So again, when we're asking services to report the cost of the class, it's okay if the cost of the class is more than what the EIG amount is being awarded is. It's okay to show us that. That's not going to hurt anybody. That's actually going to help us have the information to be able to turn around and say, hey, we need to increase. But when we're within 15% of that average, that's hard to say that there needs to be a strong adjustment. So we're very happy to see that increase going up. Also following up from our last meeting, KDOT's Drive to Zero, the dashboard that they put out on the post-crash care, timeliness of post-crash care, I guess. We're still working on getting the Department of Transportation to publish the updated base layers. So for the ambulance services, making sure that that's an accurate reflection of the ambulance services that were in existence during that five-year period. If it's something that they plan on continually updating, making sure that that is a continual update as we're going forward. Also on the air ambulance side of things to make sure that there's not an air ambulance resource at every airport, but to actually show the airports where they're located at. So making that a little more accurate coming forward. We did go ahead and calculate out two of the three time intervals that were reported on that dashboard for that same five-year time period, broke it down by county as KDOT did through looking at just the crash reports to grant as a comparison in going through to see how close, how off. I mean, as you guys remember, KDOT was reporting on 7% of the crash reports that were coming in because those were the only 93% of them didn't have a time on them for them to be able to calculate it. So we looked at the EMS run reports for all crashes. We were able to calculate on a much larger percentage, 1 in 100, but we had some times that were missing, but we were a whole lot closer. So we have some counties that are night and day difference. We have some counties that are pretty close. So we provided that information back to KDOT. We hope that that's going to continue to keep that door open for communication back and forth. They do seem very receptive to the feedback. So we'll wait to see where it goes from there, and I'll let you know on that one. Then I think the last item that I have was really an eye-opening experience. Jim and our compliance staff shared a spreadsheet with me this week. I think I'm still in the emotional state of this whole thing. So sorry if my emotions come through. I was floored by the data that they gave me. And then I was upset and saddened, really, by the whole thing. So as you're aware, our inspections and our audits are announced and scheduled. So when we go out, we're checking to see, are you in minimal, basic compliance? Just here's the rules that are there. Are you achieving those, not achieving those? 80% of our services that we've inspected this year are not meeting the minimum. So number-wise, we've done 93 this year so far. So that's 74 of them have not met that requirement. Or I guess, you know, and this was the whole balance of things. So like, well, 1 in 5 were. But that didn't help me either. So looking at it. So our biggest issue that we're seeing is no quality assurance. So we require quality assurance, QAQI, on a quarterly basis. Our biggest violation that we were seeing there was no quality assurance being performed. Missing policies was the other one, which seems a little concerning as well, because we've got a laundry list of policies that need to be addressed, and to find ones that aren't, I mean, I say it's a laundry list. There's 18 to 20 of them, but they just aren't there. So we know that some of this is due to just we have new sets of eyes looking at things, but we can't attribute that to 80%. So we've also inspected 337 ambulances during the same time frame. And this is the one that again, I'm struggling digesting this. So I'm sorry for that. But 258 of them did not meet the minimum regulatory requirements for an ambulance. That's 77%. Our single largest issue, and this is where it gets me, because it is a scheduled and announced inspection to the service. Now, the service may choose to not announce it to their staff, and we're good with that. I mean, that's what you guys do. But expired medications, number one thing that was causing a violation. Expired or inoperable equipment. Of those 258 ambulances, I know the number that I'm about to give is kind of small, but not really. 9 inoperable suction devices. An inoperable laryngoscope. These are pieces of equipment that when they're needed, they're needed. To have them not functioning is, that's a pretty big issue. And this is just our spot check, our point in time. We just showed up and take a look. I mean, scheduled, but this is just our look at it, and this is what we're finding. So the other pieces there, again, it's not that they were broken or that they're dirty. They just flat don't work. That's a problem. That's a pretty major problem, at least in our eyes. So our sponsoring organizations on the audit side of the house, at least significantly better, but not better than the service side of the things, I guess. It's still not good. So we've audited 67 sponsoring organizations. We've had 19 that have failed to meet the minimum requirements. That's about 28%. That doesn't include, as Director Wheatley mentioned during the investigations update, the 54 sponsoring organizations with a technical violation since the first of the year, 4 of which had a second violation in the last 12 months, actually the last 9 months when you look at it. So I know that we can do better as a system. I know that it's out there, so I'm hoping that the time spent on just bringing this to your light does a couple things. One, the inspections that we have remaining, because we have quite a few remaining, will take this to heart and take another look at things. And we anticipate January 1, the next year, as we're going back through, we'll see fewer issues as we're going through, and we'll see better compliance in coming through. But my ask to you is there anything that you guys want to do to help speed that natural process? I mean, your options are set fines. Your options are request those folks to come before you for a hearing to answer as to why this is going on. I mean, you've got a few other tools in the toolbox that are there, but is there anything that you're wanting to do at this time? You just kind of want to let this organically resolve? Because 80% is a big number.
I have a comment, Joe. I think your numbers are interesting. I think the way to initially, and I'm speaking from my own organization, I think all these places that are not in compliance, you start by A, sending the medical director a letter, and you send the people that are in charge, county commissioners or hospital, or the people that the EMS director or chief reports to, and just pointing out the data and the facts and asking for improvement. I think you'll see some.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I wouldn't get terribly heavy-handed, you know, and I'm glad you pointed out it could be the inspector is more. You got new people inspecting, which speaks for itself, and not in a negative manner, but if you didn't have that problem a year ago or 2 years ago, I'm not sure that it's all due to services just being neglectful. Maybe we just didn't catch it, and they've always had a suction that didn't work. Who knows? But anyway, I think you start with the simple part of notifying the commissioners or the hospital or whoever, plus the medical director, and then maybe even have them report back. I mean, in my situation, if we were on that, I'd be happy to have that conversation with the EMS guy and report back on what corrective action we took. So that's my suggestion.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I actually agree with Terry, but those are regulatory violations. Everything you listed is a violation. Your equipment has to be operable. You cannot have expired meds on your trucks. I would question whether those meds have been given. Expired meds are being given to patients. So, yeah, that's a little, that's a lot upsetting.
My other question to that would be, and I've, of course, been out of it for a while, but how many meds now you can't buy they're in low, you can't replace them because you can't get them? That's a problem. And I would tell you, you know, I sat on a federal thing many years ago on drug shortages, and compacting was a big deal then, and they talked about that, and even people at the federal level were on the committee, and don't take this as a recommendation, but the Army and the Navy have a different approach to expired meds, because the medication expirations are set by the drug manufacturers. So if I say my med and I own the company is going to expire at such and such date, frankly, that's so I'll buy some more. And the federal and the Army has figured out that from research that a lot of that stuff really doesn't expire on the date. And I'm not condoning what you found. I mean, and she's right. If it's expired, it's expired as far as what the date says, but I just point that out that, and I guess the bottom line is it'd be interesting to see how many meds you can't buy. And the question is, would I give you a med that's 30 days overdue or not give it to you at all if you really needed it? I mean, that's kind of the bottom line for me. So
I guess speaking to what Terry just said, because when I heard expired meds, it's, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, I've taken expired ibuprofen a ton. That would make me a dead woman. So I was wondering, what is there any set industry standard for what is and is not what does and does not determine expired meds? Like, I understand, for instance, if it needs to be refrigerated, then, you know, obviously that's an issue. But are these expired because the free market dictates that they have a shorter window, or because there is a medical standard that is upheld by professionals? So, you know, just asking this as your random layperson legislator who's just curious if we're following, if there is that set professional industry standard for those meds or what?
I don't have the answer to that because I'm not a pharmacist, but I think a lot of times that can affect the efficacy of your medication, and that's why they put the expiration dates on there. But that being said, Joe, do we still have the guidance document on that from the drug shortages on the website? Last time I looked, it was still there, but I don't have my computer up to look.
So, yes, we do still have the drug shortage alternative document out there. The drugs that are on shortage right now are very minimal. There might be two, might be three. There are some that are delayed. Or that they're kind of only giving you certain numbers for when you're requesting, but that's based off of usage, primarily, and what your previous purchasing habits were. As they did see, as things were like normal sailing, as it was going down, they started ratcheting back and saying, yeah, okay, you ordered two cases last year, now you're ordering six. You might not need six, but it was because folks were stockpiling.
Right.
Representative, to your question, the expirations that we're looking at are the ones the FDA requires the manufacturer to place on the medication. So the expiration date that would be on your bottle, administering that after that date would be our concern. Our concern on that side of it is the FDA does set that date based partially off of wanting to sell things, but more off the fact of the different components within the manufacturing of it. So an IV bag, they're going to take degradation at a certain temperature and a certain storage method and look at it and say, all right, this bag, if kept within this temperature range, is not going to degrade for, you know, 10 years. So we're going to set an expiration date that's an allowable percentage that's within before that starts to degrade, assuming that the bag is the part that's going to degrade first. If it's the compound itself that's going to degrade first, then it looks at that and says, okay, nope, we're going to set the expiration date based off of this. But everything is established off ideal storage temperatures, and an ambulance is not ideal storage by any stretch. We struggle to get there on a lot of meds. American Medical Response, GMR, did a phenomenal study on is years ago, but on temperatures of medications and such, and compared the temperature of the medications within the bag in the back of the truck versus being kept in a cabinet on the truck versus being kept within their storage side of things. And how many times it exceeded that allowable things. Great study. I don't know if John's actually still has access to it, but that I'll see if I can find it because it just does show that ambulances are not necessarily the ideal storage environment. So.
Thank you. I'm just curious of the 80% that you mentioned, are they able to rectify the issues on site, and do they give them any credit for that? Or I mean, just curious.
So we do give them an ability to rectify it on site. They all are taken care of. So there is feedback that goes back to the service and says, this is what we found. This needs to be resolved. You have X number of days to get it resolved. If they've got the stuff on site, then we allow it. Do they get credit for it? It was still a violation when we were there, so great that they were able to fix it. The concern is when that ambulance is out, they're typically not replacing it with something off of the truck. So if that ambulance is out on a call and that's when they encounter the expired med, their option is either administer the expired med or no med at all. They can go back to their storage area and sometimes replace what they have, but not always. It is noted, though, within the inspection itself.
Okay.
Great discussion.
It is. Any other questions for Director House on board office update? I believe, Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe, was that... in the performance-based budgeting, could that be a goal that we try to do something with that? Has that been addressed in our performance-based budgeting?
On the number of services compliant, maybe. We don't have that as one of our performance measures. We have the number of services and the number of ambulances that are inspected, because it's that performance side of it is really our agency and what we do, what we don't do. We could.
I would think that because of the issue here, somehow that needs to be addressed in that, my opinion. You might look at that and
okay.
See where that would fit.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. All right, I don't want to end on a negative note. So, right? Are you want to mention it? You want to go ahead?
You can go ahead if you would like. But that was going to be the last item for the office update of
awesome.
The two celebrities in the room.
There are two celebrities in the room. So, folks, the Kansas State Fair, great opportunity to showcase EMS, great opportunity to showcase the agency. The location where we're at within the Kansas State Fair is phenomenal. So lots of traffic that coming through, lots of positive comments coming through about our presence there and the fact that Jim and Mary Lane and the services that helped them out, and then Ashley and Sam when they came down to kind of relieve Jim and Mary Lane, because that's 10 days of absolute fun. There's never a dull moment, right? They lose years by attending the entire time. But they do a phenomenal job of providing CPR to anybody and everybody that comes by, through, and such. And they're doing it continuously, to the point at which the only complaint we received was from the guy that's across the street going, "Oh, my God, I feel like I can do CPR in my sleep." So, which is a good thing. I mean, that's, we'll take them at any point in time. So, part of that, though, is that Jim and Mary Lane do a phenomenal job of representing our agency also within the celebrity goat milking competition. And so we are back-to-back, right? Two-time champions. There's the trophy. We do have to return that back to the state fair, but they were gracious enough to allow us to bring it back as a somewhat traveling trophy coming through. The second ribbon there is, this was our 10th year of consecutive appearances at the state fair. So it was a chairman, correct? Yeah, came by, presented that to us at the fair, and then phenomenal words. Got a letter that I will share out, or how it was recapped to me with the board and such, and just their graciousness and the fact of how engaged we are. And that's mostly to Jim and Mary Lane, but also to all of the services that are coming out to help us out in that. We have great involvement from those folks coming in, and it's a long day. So they are there. Where our current location, we actually have extended hours. So I'll misspeak. It's until 10 p.m., right? And start at 10 a.m.? Yeah, 12 hours each day, so 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., where most of the other areas on the exhibitor side of the fair closed down at 5 or 6. So, but our location, we are required to kind of still be there until 10 p.m., rain or shine, because that's the fair. So they did at one point, great picture that I got. I'll see if I can share it again with you guys as well. They did take one of the CPR mannequins and set them in the dirt because they had so much rain that it wasn't dirt at that point. It was mud, but it actually looked like the mannequin was submerged up to his waist in mud, and probably somewhat true. So, but that's just the fun things of the fair. So congratulations to Jim and Mary Lane on their celebrity goat milking champions. 2 years, they'll get to go and defend that for a third year next year, because our plan is to be back at the state fair in 26. So.
I'm not sure we want to know how they practice for that. They should keep that to themselves.
Agreed. Well, very nice. Way to represent.
Our competition was Highway Patrol and Fire. So.
Hey, yeah, good job.
Very good. Well, nice job. Congratulations. Okay. No other items for office update. There's no old business, new business. If board members, you should have received all the information on the appointment of another physician to the Medical Advisory Council. Joe, do you want to kind of give a quick overview of Dr. Brinker and what the request is?
Yeah, so actually you guys have a copy of his CV and a cover letter there within the packet side of things, but Dr. Brinker is the medical director for our largest volume service in the state, so out of Sedgwick County, among a myriad of other things. So it does cover a lot of the first response agencies down there as well. Is an ER physician, I believe, oversees Newman Regional at this point as well. And so great history with an EMS side of things, I think would be a good addition to the Medical Advisory Council. That would bring their membership up to 9.
Board members have any questions, concerns, comments?
I'll make a motion.
Just need a motion and a second, so.
I'll make a motion to approve.
Great, motion and a second, so any discussion? Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, that passes. And then, Joe, you'll notify Dr. Brinker and the chair of the MAC as well? Perfect, thank you. Actions from standing committees. Anything from, I don't believe, there was not an education meeting yesterday, so brings us to planning and operations, which we'll have a little bit of discussion. So as we discussed at the last board meeting, there's a couple of items that we, the planning operations and the board, we referred back to the MAC for some discussion on, which they had, the MAC did have a meeting 2 weeks ago, roughly a week and a half ago, probably. Was it? Okay. Had some discussion, so a few of those items were, one of them was transfer of patient care from a higher level of care provider, ALS provider, such as a paramedic or a advanced EMT, transferring that level of care to a BLS provider for transport to the hospital. The MAC did identify that they felt that there may be certain times where certain situations where that would be appropriate for that to occur, but did not really identify what those situations may be. So we've referred that back to Director House to take that back to the MAC to see if we can get a list of things. But we also wanted to discuss that a little bit amongst us. But I think the goal is to just let it go back to the MAC to identify situations where that would be appropriate, as well as when those recommendations come back, agencies that are going to do that have a policy or a document. And that was a recommendation from a service director and Dave Johnston from Reno County EMS that they actually already have a guideline or a document in place to allow for that to occur when those situations arise. So that would be a situation for us, for the board, to move in that direction to require some sort of a policy document, guideline, something of that nature in writing, with that agency would have something in writing and to identify those situations for that to be allowable to occur, if that makes sense.
Question.
Yes.
Comment. Joe, can we do that as a protocol? Because the medical director has to approve a protocol and not necessarily a policy. And if we want medical director involvement, I think just my, I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, so part two from planning ops, so one of the things I was working on draft-wise, I got one of the drafts to you. Didn't get the other one there.
Okay, that's okay.
The request made was to have the policy be approved by the medical director, so that we would delineate that within the plan, at least, in my mind, because it's not in words yet, was to delineate that within the regulation to say this is a policy that has to be approved by specifically by the medical director.
Some sort of a document, whether it's specifically addressed as a or identified as a protocol or
right,
a guideline, patient care guideline or something of that nature.
Yeah.
But would have to be approved and signed off on by the medical director to occur. So with that, so 10934 is the regulation for EMT authorized activities that we discussed at the August meeting that that would have included that information. And Joe, correct me if I don't get this correct. So we're striking the language that would identify that currently, and moving 10934 forward.
Yes.
With the exception of that, correct?
Yeah, so 10934 had a phrase that talked about, that really triggered the conversation. But it was in response to the board saying they wanted this addressed. So because it was the contentious language side of it, we just proposed to strike it, which is what Plan and Ops pushed forward to the board to have today, was just to move forward with regulation with the language that was added, removed. So,
right. Striking subsection 3 and then recommend and having adding the language of a policy regarding transferring of patient care to a lower level provider.
Within a different reg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that will, yeah, that'll be identified in a different regulation. That'll be 10925 where that will get added. Is that right?
More than likely.
Okay.
We'll find where it fits the best. 2.5 is probably it. That's all ambulance service operational standards. So
that was voted to move forward from the planning and ops to the full board for adoption as well.
You wanted a motion then?
We need a motion and a second.
I'll make a motion to approve the document as we've presented with the controversial statement removed and moved to another regulation.
I'd second that.
Okay. Got a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Okay. All those in favor? Nope. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sam, do you review those kind of things?
Any other questions or discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Item number 2 under old business, the medication list. Requested modifications. Again, that was a discussion that we've had a couple of different times. One of those medications being IV acetaminophen being added to the list. The recommendations from the MAC was to add IV acetaminophen, make no changes regarding IV fluids and electrolyte additives. If you guys recall from the last meeting, there was a recommendation to change to identifying specific electrolytes, and those are the items we sent to the MAC to discuss. They came back with a recommendation to leave it as it is and make no changes to IV fluids with electrolyte additives, and then they made an additional recommendation to add all ACLS medications to the advanced EMT medication list, specifically speaking to sodium bicarb and mag sulfate for cardiac arrest. I guess from my perspective, there's a couple of making the recommendation for all ACLS medications, but then identifying two different medications to add to the list kind of contradict themselves, because there's multiple other medications in the ACLS guidelines for post-cardiac arrest care, return to spontaneous circulation, that identifies medications that only a paramedic typically can administer. So if this is something to be discussed further, I think that the recommendation, and me personally, we would like to send this back either back to the MAC or with Dr. Selberg is on today, and he attended the MAC meeting. Maybe a little bit more direction from Dr. Selberg and or Dr. Feynman, since they're both on the meeting this morning, just for some clarification purposes. Back and forth with, you know, information on administration of mag sulfate and how that occurs. So if either physician or Dr. Selberg, since you were on the MAC meeting, if you want to elaborate a little bit, if you would. He is muted.
Well, it's showing on hold at the moment.
Okay.
So might be it. And it might be a volume thing, too.
Senator, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just kind of a 101 question. Do you look at this medicine list and you decide what goes on, what goes off? Is there a national association that comes out and says, here's the list? and it's a little different, and I kind of, this is somebody that don't have any
sure.
idea about medicine, so that's why.
How
do you decide that process?
So this, and Joe, if you want to, the process for this medication list has been, I don't know how many years in the making and evolving, compared to what the National Registry of EMTs has for an advanced EMT, that medication list is different than what ours is. Ours includes the medications that the National Registry utilizes, but is expanded substantially. I would say quite a bit from what the national standard would be for an advanced EMT, which there's things in place for that to occur, but I'm not sure.
So
that answers your question.
Yeah, there is a national EMS scope of practice, not necessarily the national registry, because the registry just builds their exam based upon two things. One, the scope of practice model for that level of certification, and then two, practice analysis. So they kind of look out there and say, hey, what's being done, what's going on, and do we need to adjust our items or test questions based upon what's being done out there? So then the national scope of practice really drives a lot of the baseline side of things, to which the sole pain relief medication on the AEMT side of things on the national scope is nitrous oxide. So everything else that you see on here that looks like a pain reliever is not necessarily on the national list, but that's okay because we've addressed that. So because it's on this list, our Kansas programs are having to teach it. Our bigger concern comes from our surrounding states as to whether they adopt something similar or not. So we push a lot of that burden onto ambulance services to ensure that, hey, it says here they can give amiodarone. Do they have the education to do it? Do they have the competency to do it? Should they be doing it based off of what we know of this provider? So there's a lot of trust that goes on the ambulance service side of things to ensure that their folks have that knowledge and going through. But that's kind of where this starts from. It is based upon practice within the state, and then additions, modifications, we do ask if it's a standard or not from the Medical Advisory Council.
It then has to be approved by the local medical director, too, that oversees the service. So that's kind of the gatekeeper.
So I don't know if Dr. Silberg is not able to. Okay. I don't. Frank, are you?
He's bedside with four patients right now.
Okay. Understood.
So he's practicing right now in the ED.
Okay.
He's trying to get back to the phone right now.
That's fine. And no one else from the MAC is on, are they? Okay. Well, I'm not sure. I guess from my perspective, wanting some, I guess I would like some clarification, a little bit of clarification from the MAC before we take any action on adding more medications to the med list. Yeah.
I think that's a legitimate question. You know, what? Give us more of that context.
Right.
And what exactly are they wanting and not wanting? Because I agree, if it's anything ACLS, then that's a pretty big, that opens up some things
sure.
that may not be intended to be on there. So, or maybe that is their intention, but I think some context from
yeah.
them.
If it's just specific, one or, you know, just to mag sulfate and sodium bicarb for cardiac arrest, is it necessary? How far along, you know, how necessary is that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the question came up yesterday from someone about, are we talking adults, peds, or both?
Correct.
Because...
Well, and the fact that ACLS is
getting ready
due
to change.
For an update.
So that was one of the other recommendations from the other committee, the ad hoc committee members from the regions and the professional organizations, is the American Heart Association should be coming out with a new standard on cardiac arrest management, medications, things of that nature. That will take effect short, probably by the end of the first quarter of 2026. And if this is something that at that point could even wait until those new standards come out to ensure that there's no significant changes or any big changes being recommended from the American Heart Association for cardiac arrest management and resuscitation before we take any action to make a recommendation one way or the other.
Are those the only two items that impact moving it forward or not?
The ACLS meds, adding those? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the draft that's before you, mm-hmm. folks in the room, it's also sitting on the back table, was just the addition of IV acetaminophen because that was what was...
That was what, yeah, yeah, we agreed on. That was not an issue to move it forward to be added to the med list.
And my gauging of the Medical Advisory Council was they also anticipated more discussion on the ACLS medications based upon the fact we did ask that there would probably be, well, advised, there would probably be clarification requested as to which meds and whether it's, sure. you know, just those that were dealing with the pulseless rhythm versus those that had a pulsatile rhythm. So
what, and the question between adults and pediatrics is a legitimate question.
It is.
So what's your recommendation to just move it forward and then table the other items?
We can just move forward with just the IV acetaminophen being added to the list at this point.
I'd make that motion then.
I'll second.
Okay. Got a motion and a second to add IV acetaminophen to the med list discussion. Yes, sir.
Just a comment. I'm kind of surprised it isn't already on the list. That'd be the first thing I'd say. And we all know that Tylenol is being discussed nationally.
I didn't point that out.
to be adding that, and I'm surprised it's not already there. So that was my comment.
So Tylenol itself, acetaminophen, has been on there orally for a long time. Yeah. The IV side has not been, and I think that it probably was never really that prevalent up until recently of patients, and this came from a smaller hospital and EMS agency that is routinely transferring or being asked to transfer patients to a higher level of care facility, that they've got physicians that routinely utilize IV acetaminophen for pain management during those transfer times rather than providing narcotics. So that's where this came from, and I think that there's probably a growing trend for that to occur, potentially for that medication to be utilized outside the hospital for transfers versus those providers being able to administer pain medications, narcotic pain medications. So that's probably why it took so long, just because it wasn't that, it had never really been requested or asked for, where a lot of these other medications had been in the past that we've added. So, but it's a good question, and I think that for the most part, everybody agreed that it was an easy addition for this medication list. Okay, any other discussion? Yes.
So for consideration, and again, I mentioned this, I think, just to the chair prior to the meeting, because this was drafted on the fly. It was just drafted last night. So to add that, we would probably request as staff the board to consider, instead of it saying not approved for the EMT, to say oral, so that there's not a conflict with because acetaminophen is an over-the-counter antipyretic. Sure. So or the non-opioid
just adding oral to that
Yeah, since
EMT category.
Therefore, there wouldn't be a conflict, so, yeah.
That makes sense.
I'm good with that for the motion.
Okay. All right. So we're going to add, board staff will add oral under the EMT scope of practice for acetaminophen as a amendment to the motion. Any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
All right, that passes. New business. So I don't destroy this, Joe, would you just give a quick update on the rural health care transformation opportunities and kind of what we discussed in the committee and the report that came out earlier this week?
I'll do my best on that one. So,
and Frank, you were involved in that meeting, correct? Or in that discussion? Either one.
So, contained within the Big Beautiful Bill was the Rural Health Transformation Grant, which basically will bring in $100 million to the state of Kansas each year for the next 5 years to be utilized to transform rural health on things. So I will throw a little bit of shade at the state of Kansas. Sorry. We're behind the eight ball in comparison to our neighboring states who have done phenomenal job of reaching out for stakeholder engagement prior to this whole thing. The deadline for submission is November 5th. For the state, single point within the state that has to apply for it. So the state of Kansas's single point will be KDHE, is my understanding. And so there's a group of four of them, Secretaries Stanek and Howard. So Secretary Stanek from the Department of Health and Environment, Secretary Howard from KDADS, along with Dr. Bob Mosier and Jody Schmidt with the Care Collaborative are the four that are kind of overseeing the Kansas operation side of this. Their first deadline is for submissions of ideas by 3 p.m. today, which the Kansas EMS Association, KEMSA, has done a phenomenal job of trying to gather as much as they possibly can to put forth something to propose by 3 p.m. today. And it's been a lot of engagement on their parts, a lot of work by Dave Johnston in getting through, but in coordination with both Frank and Chrissy on ensuring that things are met and going forward. And again, Frank can absolutely step in here at any point on that side of it. So that in addition to that $100 million, the state of Kansas will qualify for the other portion of the funding that CMS gets to quote unquote discretionally spend or expend, which could lead up to another $100 million into the state. So there's a potential big pot coming through. The big thing with these opportunities is that there has to be sustainability for it. So it's not as though it can just come in, go out, and be done. So some great ideas came forth. Just a second. I can mute. I can't unmute. How about that? So With the opportunities that are out there, there were some ideas gathering again, very short time frame. There was a webinar Monday at 9 a.m. That kind of went over what the ground rules for the state of Kansas were going to be, what the process would look like. There is an alliance being built of individuals to try to carry the voice as this goes through and really help with the decision-making process. But the members of that alliance have not been announced yet. I believe their first deadline is the middle of next week to have some of these things reviewed and looked at and going through. So we are on an extremely short timeline to try to get this stuff through or to see what comes out. EMS is specifically called out within it. things that are tied to improving the system, reducing cost, are 100% within the notice of funding opportunity that's out there. So, again, KMSA's done a phenomenal job on trying to identify some of the big things that need to be addressed or should be addressed within this opportunity in going forward, and we're going to continue to support their efforts in getting those at least presented within the time frame. So we have provided some data, big components, things that were being looked at, trying to address transfers from rural facilities to higher levels of care, covering treatment in place, trying to help with reimbursement there, transport to alternate destinations, helping with that, assisting with the mobile integrated health, so infrastructure necessary to do that along with reimbursement side of things, to look a little bit on the recruitment retention side of things by, I think, expanding educational or allowing our more education to occur within things. We proposed a linkage with health information exchanges, which we provided that language to those folks, or to KMSA, to help on that side of things. Frank, what am I forgetting? There's some big ones.
Good morning, Frank Williams, representing KMSA. Thanks to the collaboration of the Board of EMS, especially Joe's data, and as he described, a lot of motion in the background. We apologize that there hasn't been more collaboration, but the timeline just hasn't allowed for us to pull this data together. There's specifics that need to be submitted by 3 o'clock today, or we don't have a say at the table. So, yeah, the workforce and the ability to enhance, we've been in contact with our community colleges, and how does that look for paramedic programs, enhancing the funding there. Mobile integrated health was another big hitter and specifically called out in the federal HR 1 bill. So those dollars have been requested in the proposal. The other collaborations as far as dispatch and the ability to route calls EMD-wise is another portion of that. And then technology for remote access and virtual medical direction is a big part of that as well. So those are just some of the additional ones.
So what we will, we're going to continue to work
sure
with them. We're comfortable on allowing KMSA to take lead and continue to allow KMSA to take the lead on this and supporting them through this. I don't see anybody's head shaking so in a negative manner, so I'm going to continue doing that. Thought that was the right thing to do from the get-go. So, again, the provider-level involvement in our surrounding states look to be very beneficial to the state's plans going forward. So that was the decision we made within the office on allowing or continuing this side of things. So that's our plan. Our plan. Their plan is great. So,
yeah, we've had a lot of cooperative efforts from Missouri and their EMS association. Like Joe pointed out, they started in June as a state to try to put all this information together. So we've leaned on them quite a bit and done comparables with other states to try to hit the mark and have the best opportunity for maximizing that for EMS. Again, it's focused on rural communities, and the hospital association's been a big part of this collaboration as well to try to get the funding where it needs to be. So.
Thank you, Frank. Any comments or questions? Yes, Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Williams, for your presentation. You might stay up here if you would. I want to ask you a question real quick.
Okay.
I think you addressed this, but I know that there are some people working on the 911 to help individuals. Like if my spouse was to have a heart attack and live 50 miles out in the country, and the PSAP, you know, being able to talk that spouse through what they could be doing while the ambulance is on the way. Was that part of that?
Yeah, Senate Bill 11, I believe, is what you're referring to. And So we've, as KMSA, have been part of the consultation for that and the subcommittee that's working on vetting through some of the challenges. And yes, TCPR and or EMD is a part of this proposal. Yes. Yeah, and the 911 board has also been consulted.
Thank you.
That answer your question?
Okay.
Senator Fascado.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. Did you say that this is only being implemented in rural areas? Is that what you said? Thank you.
Correct.
Yeah, the primary focus from HR1 is to distribute these dollars to enhance rural communities, and we haven't heard exactly what that definition is and whether that's Medicare, CMS, or whether there's other specifics defined.
If I can.
Yep.
Oh, am I next?
Yep, go right ahead. Okay. Sorry, we'll get to you.
Just wanted to add a quick comment. In the conversations I've had around these $500 million coming towards us, one of the biggest needs I've heard is transportation to and from treatments, dialysis, chemotherapy, things like, there's a lot of mistreatments that have resulted in hospitalizations because they don't have a way to get there. I know Medicaid doesn't always cover everything. Medicare is kind of up in the air. So just wanted to throw that out there that I've heard that a lot in my area.
Thank you, Representative Essex. Yes. So the goal with the language, at least, that's being crafted is to be broad enough for those other ideas to come in after the November 4th submission and how that actually lines up in detail. So we'll add that information. Yeah.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think you probably have already addressed this as well as you do this, Frank. Rural hospitals versus a critical hospitals, there's kind of a black hole that there are some hospitals. Will that be addressed in that area, or can you make sure that that's addressed?
Yeah, I think in the verbiage that we've heard, the brownout areas, yeah. The Kansas Hospital Association, I know, is deep into their data collection and their portion of the proposal as well. So I can't answer directly because that deals with hospitals, but I do know Kansas Hospital Association was being consulted about that.
Hopefully they're all over that. Thank
yes.
You. Any other questions or comments? Perfect. Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Joe, thank you for as well. The last part of the planning and operations, we heard from regional and professional organizations on updates on some things happening in the KC metro area with the World Cup coming, updates on a whole blood program that is starting in the Kansas City, the marker group area. Other items from KMSA and educational opportunities that are coming up soon with a core conference in Pratt in the early November. And then we did hear from Region 5, and for those of you that were unaware, there was a longtime Kansas EMS provider and service director for Pottawatomie County EMS that passed away just a few weeks ago, and service arrangements and a memorial service for him were conducted, and had a large turnout from emergency services and EMS agencies across the state that honored him. And the service director at Anderson County, correct? Is that where Troy's at? Garnett, that kind of organized all that and was kind of the lead on that. So that was the end of our business for the Planning and Operations Committee. I believe no executive session necessary. Anyone else have any comments or questions? I would entertain a motion for adjournment then. If there's no other questions or any other business. Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We are adjourned. Thank you.